Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. This classic episode was produced by the team at Pandora.
This is Sugar Steve, and on this week's Questlove Supreme Classic, hip-hop icon and R&B hitmaker Jermaine Dupri tells 30 years of industry tales, from Fresh Fest days to career-reviving remixes. Originally released August 22nd, 2018.
Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
My name is Questlove.
Yeah.
Spitting hot tracks.
Yeah.
Interviewing the man.
Yeah.
With the world's loudest hi-hat.
Roll call. Yeah. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call.
My name is Sugar.
Yeah.
Money ain't a thing.
Yeah.
Cause I don't have much.
Yeah.
Sucks for me.
Roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call.
You're going against
Suprema.
Suprema roll call.
This show's off the hook.
Yeah.
Like Escape Second LP.
Yeah.
Boss Bill is my name.
Yeah.
On QLS with JD.
Roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call.
It's Lie.
Yeah.
With the legend JD.
Yeah.
Been down with him.
Yeah.
Since I was at the AUC.
Roll call.
Okay, okay.
Suprema. Suprema roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call.
My name is JD.
Yeah.
It's all about me.
Yeah.
Celebrating 25 years in this crazy ass industry.
Hey. Suprema. Suprema roll call.
Uh-huh.
Suprema. Suprema roll call.
Yeah.
Suprema. Suprema roll call.
Yeah.
Suprema. Suprema roll call.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Questlove Supreme. All right, I got to get this out once in the open. Jermaine, why are your hi-hats so loud on your record? That is, am I the only person that mentions your hi-hat game?
You're the only person that ever asks why, right? And I'm glad that you asked why, because I feel like I don't get the credit for hi-hats being that loud on records now.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that you're saying that, because I did that deliberately as my thing to make, you know, like when I first, I'm going to tell you where I got it from, right? I got it from
777-9311. Oh, wait, are we about to break his heart right now?
No, go ahead.
I'll let Prince take the credit.
Keep going.
Go ahead.
I mean, the way the hi-hats sound on that record,
yeah,
that's the focus. When I was younger and I was playing drums, that's all I used to try to play, that beat. And my focus was that hi-hat. So then, you know, for some reason when I started making beats on the drum machine, I just wanted my beats to sound like that. So once I started making one and people said something about the hi-hat, I was like, oh, okay, this is my thing. So then I did it on You Make Me Wanna with Usher record, and it was like... That's the first time you heard the...
It was loud as his voice.
Yes, very loud. And that's how I wanted it. I wanted you to be able to turn the record down as low as you could possibly turn it down and hear the vocals and the hi-hat.
See, the thing is, though, now we have like technology that doesn't, we don't have to spin on records anymore, you know, because we used to ride and whatnot. But the thing is that usually shuffles and hi-hats leave an imprint on the wax.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you look at Thriller, the shuffle of Billie Jean leaves a sort of spiral design inside the actual groove of the wax. So
You're very technical. I've never waited to
tell you. Yeah, but all of your...
Wait a second. You're staring at the vinyl of Thriller with a microscope.
Actually, come on. Let me tell you something. Yeah. This is something I noticed when I was like 3 years old. So. I know exactly what you're talking about. It looks like Tiger
Stripes. Yeah, the grooves of all the other songs on Thriller look normal, but Billie Jean, like, that's when I noticed, like, oh, high-end fidelity stuff, they leave an imprint on the wax, which... leads to any time I've spun anything produced by you, especially Money Ain't a Thing, there's this whole... What was the game we used to get as kids where you do the... Like, what was it? Spiral Graph? Yeah. It's not a game, but...
The spinning thing.
Yeah, is that still a thing today, or is that like, did I just date myself?
Yes, I don't know.
Paragraph.
I don't know what that is.
Okay, JD.
Were you?
Because JD was born in 1998.
Yeah, I don't know what that is.
Come on, JD. Come on, bro. Spirograph. Will you take us? Never mind.
No.
Okay, well, this is Classic Questlove Supreme, where I didn't even officially introduce our guest. Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode. I had to get the hi-hat. I'm a drummer. I had to get the hi-hat question out the way.
I'm glad you did that.
All right, so another episode of Questlove Supreme. Hello, Team Supreme.
Hey.
I assume that Fonte is fixing his countertop or his pool, or whatever.
Or making videos doing it, whatever.
Yeah, exactly. I will say that enough has not been said about our next guest, and I believe that he also agrees with me that enough has not been said about him. That's sort of like one of the dangerous things about hip-hop culture, or this disposable hip-hop culture that we have, where, you know, we discover great resources and we use them to the hilt, and then we kind of... or onto the next thing, and revisionism sets in, and usually the person with the biggest check gets to rewrite history, and suddenly everyone has a foggy memory on who pioneered what and whatnot. But I will say that numbers don't lie, and for 35 plus years, our guest today has been a figurehead in hip hop in all the areas, be it as a producer, as a songwriter, for some of the defining moments in hip hop and R&B culture, or as a label head, a manager, and as an artist in his own right. I can even say a dancer. This man is connected to more people than I care to announce. If I announce them all, the show will be over. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to Questlove Supreme, the one and only Jermaine Dupri.
Whoa, what an intro. I need to use that intro on my DJ set. I'm gonna use that. That's what I'm gonna use.
Ladies and gentlemen,
JD.
So how's it going, man?
Oh, it's going.
All right. So for our listeners, and I'm trying to pack every question I can. First of all, I was shocked. You were born in Asheville, North Carolina?
Asheville, yeah. Asheville, North Carolina.
Isn't that the hippie community?
I'm not sure. I left there when I was two.
Okay. Because
I'm not sure.
Usually for the roots, usually Asheville, North Carolina is like, it's such a hippie territory.
It's like a mountain town, so.
Yes. Yeah. Like some of the, think of like the Bonnaroos, but times a billion. Like there's always jam bands performing there, and, you know, we've done many a show there. Cause
sounds like JD ain't been back.
I was put in Atlanta when I was two.
Okay, so what made your family move to Atlanta?
Because Atlanta's the big city to Asheville, and, you know, North Carolina is like, that's what they look to I guess back then is the place to go to have like fun. Like it's almost like how people go from LA to Vegas, and you know what I mean, it's like that type of situation. I think
so. As far you got in the business early, but describe what life was like in Atlanta, because usually I'll say that for me, my first education on Atlanta, especially being how old I was, were the unfortunate the Atlanta child murder situation.
Sure.
With Wayne Williams.
Yeah.
Who looks, I know my Boss Bill looking at me like, don't say nothing out of line. But then he kind of looked like Walter Clyde Orange from the Commodores.
Oh my God.
Wow. Wow.
Oh my God.
Sorry. Now that you said it.
Walter Klein, the orange from the Commodores. Yeah, yeah. Everyone's shaking their head. Yeah, Walter, I love you. You're my idol. You're a drummer. Anyway, that was my introduction to Atlanta. But what was your childhood like in Atlanta? Like, did it always have culture? And
I think, you know, you know, skating for kids was the culture of Atlanta. Like, so when you see like ATL, that movie was basically what my childhood was. That was it for me, to go to the skating rink. You get away from your parents, you get to listen to music, you get to dance, you get to skate, you get to talk to girls. Everything happened at the skating rink. That was for young kids anyway. Coming up, basically, that was it for me. And then talent shows. Atlanta was full of talent shows. All the schools had talent shows. And, you know, I was just doing that, hitting schools and doing talent shows and going to skating rink. It was not really much. It wasn't really much of a music scene in Atlanta, but it was a scene for like dancers and the culture, like I'm saying, like skating and stuff like that. Musically, it wasn't really. We had SOS Band and we had Brick,
okay,
and that was, you know, oh, and Peebo Bryson, and those were, Peebo was like, you know, he was like Rick Ross in Atlanta back then. Like,
word?
that was his, you know, that's Peebo's town.
He'd basically be up in the club and then
Peebo. He was, wait, just, did you? Know, he had the penthouse downtown. You know, you used to drive by my dad. He'd be like, that's Peebo Bryson's house. And I should be like, man, I'm going to get me one of them shits one day. Like, he's just, you know, like that. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah.
So was your father always in the music industry or was...
Yeah, from what I can remember, my dad was basically like a roadie that turned into like a road manager, that turned into like a, you know, a production manager more than anything. Because my dad played drums, so he was like more like a production guy for the drummers of Brick and, you know, SOS Band. And then he got into, you know, morphed into more, doing more production for, you know, doing more production for all of these artists. And I used to just be there at rehearsal watching and looking, and then Cameo, and, you know,
right.
It started growing, but it was just, those were the main artists in Atlanta.
How old were you at that point when you were watching these bands?
Like 9.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, like 9.
That sounds about right.
Yeah.
Now, we've discovered here on Questlove Supreme that all the name brand super producers have some sort of DJ history before they went into production. So did you have any DJ history prior to your...
Yeah, 100%. I mean, when I went on the Fresh Fest at 12... Grandmaster D basically was showing me how to DJ. He's like, I didn't know what to scratch. Like, scratch. He showed me how to scratch. Mm-hmm. I used to just want to always scratch. I used to go behind the turntables while they was doing sound check and try to scratch. And he's like, yo, don't touch my set. I'm going to show you how to do it. So I kind of, you know, I could say I got personal lessons from Grandmaster D and Jam Master J of how to actually DJ. And, you know, actually scratch and, you know, go back and forth on the records. Like, that's what my introduction to DJing. So then I left the tour and went home and I told my parents that, you know, I want turntables for Christmas.
That's so weird because, like, coming up, because Run DMC, because Jay actually scratched on Run DMC records, I always wonder why Larry Smith never let Grandmaster D physically scratch, not until like the third record, when the Open Sesame record, then I finally heard scratch and I was like, oh, he can cut. But everybody and their mother swore to God that like Grandmaster D was like stealing the show at the Fresh Fest, doing like all these tricks on his head. And so he was a legit bona fide DJ.
Yeah, 100%.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, he was, you know, all the tricks, and they'll pick him up and he'd scratch, you know, with his mouth on the crossfader. Right. And yeah, he was doing it. He was going.
So, being as though the Fresh Fest was the first major stadium tour for hip hop, mm-hmm. One, how did you get on the Fresh Fest? Two, what was that shit like?
Well, I got on the Fresh Fest because the Fresh Fest was created in Atlanta by a guy by the name of Ricky Walker. Ricky Walker now has created Universe Soul Circus.
Oh,
it's the same guy. This okay. guy created that, and then he went and did the circus thing now. But he created the Fresh Fest, and my father was the production manager on the Fresh Fest. And they just needed an open act. You know, at that time, they used to be like, they need an opening act to kill time or buy time or whatever it was, and they would just put anybody on.
No in-house music playing, no iPods.
Yeah, nothing. Yeah, it wasn't nothing like that. They needed somebody to, you know, buy, you know, give. I don't even understand what that was, but they was buying time, basically. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they was like, well, do y'all have anybody to put on? And they suggested that I could come out and dance, and they let me come out and dance. And the show in Atlanta was the first show of the Fresh Fest, and it worked well with the time. Mm-hmm. So then it was like, well, can Jermaine do this for the rest of the tour? And I ain't know what that was. My mother ain't know what it was. Nobody knew what it was. There wasn't no money involved. It was just like...
What was your routine?
I had a dance routine where I came out to It's Time and a couple of other records where I just was just on stage freestyling, just dancing. And I was little, so, you know, when you're a little kid dancing, so you, the crowd goes crazy. So it was like a, it was kind of like the circus, kind of. Like, you know what I mean? You just, you don't know what you're looking at. You're just watching, and it looks like I'm doing more than what I probably was doing.
So how many acts were on? Well, I know it was Fatboys, Houdini, and Run DMC. Who, like, I'm sure there had to have been accessory groups on
there. Everybody was on
there.
UTFO was on the tour. Grandmaster Flash was on the tour. Everybody that was hot at that era was on the tour.
How long would each act get?
Probably like 15 minutes. I mean, they never had that many records. And Run was really like, you know, this is my shit, so you gotta, you know.
Oh, so.
Y'all better hurry up. You know, Reverend Run had a real, you know, he had that real thing about him. And Curtis Blow was on the tour. So it was Curtis Blow, Run DMC, the Fat Boys, Houdini, Grandmaster Flash, the Dynamic Breakers, and I think Ozone and Turbo.
Whoa.
Yeah, yeah.
See, this is what I appreciate, because I know as a youngster, as a person that was young then, you were definitely in a fly on the wall situation that anyone else couldn't, like, if I were, whatever, 30 plus years old, at the front, they'd be like, hey, get the fuck out of here. But with you as a kid, I'm certain that you were allowed in spaces that
I wasn't supposed to be in. But at the same time, they was trying to tell me, get the fuck out of there. But it was like, I was just like, no, I'm, you know, I'm right here. I'm not paying no attention to y'all doing this. And I'm not, you know, but I've seen everything.
But
I
it's just
everything.
Anyone from that era never has a recollection. Like DMC, you know, I'll ask him a few things and he, man, my memory's foggy. I don't remember, man. Like, you know, so
I remember everything.
It's good to finally get.
And I've been trying to do this movie about, basically about my life, kind of like that. And I've been having people tell me that it's hard to do a movie for a kid showing what I want y'all to see that I saw.
Streaming.
Because it's
you gotta go to Netflix.
It's R-rated and it's not, you know.
You gotta go to Netflix.
And that's it sounds like a series too, because that's a long life. That's
well, I mean, I don't know how far to get back, but I'm really more concerned about that, because what he's saying is that I know the stuff. It's not even like history. It's like a kid seeing what you don't understand a kid saw. Like, I saw artists come to life. I saw artists doing drugs. I just saw everything that at 12 you don't really understand what you're seeing.
At the time, since you're going, you're touring and whatnot, is your dad your only chaperone? Because he's working.
Yeah,
so
he's not really even a chaperone. I'm out there basically by myself. He's working. I'm running around. All of these other guys are my chaperones. That's why Houdini, like, for real, that's why Houdini actually became like my brothers, and, you know, they became like the guys that was with me all the time. Not that my father wasn't paying attention. It was just that I saw that as a move for me to start getting away from him and just, like, hanging out more. And I wasn't like out late at night and nothing like that. None of the guys ever let me do anything like that. It was just all about the tour, and like when the show was going on, I was everywhere at the show, all over the place.
Wait, this is how nerdy I am, because it didn't even occur to me to ask about, like, oh, the salacious shit you saw. My nerd ass is trying to figure out, well, wait a minute, what was the backline situation? So, like, what was sound check like? I know monitors are ringing. Like, I'm trying to figure out, like, how does, from a production standpoint, how does the show run concurrently and smoothly without this DJ being like, who broke my mixer? Then,
like, nah, they all had different sets. So it was like probably like five tables sitting in the back, right? So every time somebody come off, they'll move that table and put that guy's set up there. And nobody was using the same turntables. That definitely wasn't happening on that tour.
See, that era was scaring me, because I know that with dancers, there's always skipping records. And
that's what made Jam Master Jay, to me, one of the best live DJs ever, because
he knew
how to, you know, move in a land of where that would never happen. He was like a drummer on. He was like you on stage. Like, he could really just, like, do whatever he wanted with those turntables and make them, you know, play the way he wanted them to play.
So when they asked you, I'm sorry, I just want, when they asked you to do the record years later, what was the Down with the King joint? Because that was the only time y'all worked together again. The next time.
Run DMC, yeah.
That must have been like a whole full circle moment, since, you know, going from a kid, and what you were saying, how, you know, Run was such a boss on tour and whatnot.
I mean, it was, all of it's a full circle. I signed Houdini to Social Death. Like, it was a complete full circle. Like, I was a kid looking up to these guys, and they was teaching me and telling me things, and then I felt so, you know, connected to them that I wanted to sign them and give them what I felt like I was giving to the rest of the world.
So when it was over, like the last day of the Fresh Fest,
I don't even remember that.
Well, okay. Were they all? I know there were like two or three Fresh Fests. Did you do it every year, or just
the
one particular year? 84,
85, and 86.
Okay, so when the Fresh Fest is officially over, like, how do you return to normalcy? How do you go back to Atlanta or wherever your home base was? Assume that you lived in Atlanta. Like, how do you explain this to your friends? How do you explain what you saw? And like,
well, that's what actually really happened. Is like, when I went on tour at 12, right? And in Atlanta wasn't a city that was used to performing artists.
Right.
We don't have a performing arts school or nothing like that when I was 12. So I was in a regular school, and I had a tutor. But when I came back from tour, and I took my grades back to the school system told my tutor that they couldn't accept it. Like, they just was like, we're not used to this. We're not going to accept all of this work. So I'm like, wait a minute, I did this work. You're not going to make it seem, I'm not going to be left back. I was on the bus doing work. Like, right. I had a tutor. So right then and there, I was like, man, fuck this. I'm not doing this. So it was like, my life changed right there. At like 14, 15 years old, my life just changed, where it was like, I became doing home study, and I didn't go to school anymore. And then it was just like the drive to make sure that this didn't turn into something completely bad.
But was it weird for you? Because, you know, on tour, I don't know if you had anyone to relate to that was your age. And then you're not in an environment, in a school environment, where you have sop hops or a prom or, you know, just like regular, you know.
Sock hops?
Okay, motherfucker, I'm 50.
That's worse than this.
I said sop.
What's
sop?
What is that?
That's the sophomore prom.
What's a sop hop?
S-O-P, sop hop.
Do it,
I think Bill knows where I'm talking. What the word? Are you going to leave me out here alone?
I only know it is because I heard you say sophomore prom.
I saw it on Grease.
Sop hops are...
That's where John Travolta and Olivia Newton-John went.
Okay,
in the
maybe
middle
someone
of
that went to school in the 80s. Like,
I'm
that
telling
was...
you what it is. It's a good reference.
Please explain it to me.
I thought you said sock hop.
It's right, where Olivia.
I get it, Jay. You're.
I mean,
you
I was 12.
Born in 2000.
I was 12 in the 80s.
You're
you said
still
this...
12 now. I get it. I get it.
Tell me what it was. Come on.
You're I young. Okay. I get it.
All right. When they were wearing
sock hops are like the senior dance thing.
Right.
Senior
prom. Oh yeah. I never.
Then you go on your junior prom. Then you go on your senior prom.
But it happened in the 50s.
No, that's sock.
It's
sock. You're thinking of Greece. Okay, sock. S-O-P. I have a cold, so.
I don't know what that is.
Someone, means. All right, okay.
I don't know what it is.
All right, thank you.
I'm the oldest person in the room. Know. Thank you, yeah. Steve.
I don't know what that is.
Your frisbee probably. And your hula hoop just arrived. <also. laughs>
Your Nerf ball.
Anyway, all right, here's my point. My point is that, you know, I don't know, like, what your relationship is like with your cousins or your family, but just to not. To be isolated from people your age, like, how was it? Was it a lonely, isolated experience where it's just like, I'm hanging with these adults all the time and not?
Nah, because I looked at it like this was the only way I was going to get close to what I was in love with at the time. And these guys was dancing all day. You said you wanted to know what soundcheck was like. Soundcheck right. was like, because we had two stages. We had a middle stage and we had a big stage, right? The rappers was on the main stage, and then the stage in the middle was all the dancers. So in soundcheck, all the dancers would be out there dancing together all at one time, like just everybody dancing. So it's like I'm getting the opportunity to see moves and all of this stuff, and I'm not watching videos. I'm actually watching this and I'm learning. So it was, to me, it was like being at school, but the school that I wanted to be at.
I first heard about you, before the internet, Ride On magazine was like every black teen's like religion.
You know what that is, JD?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
I know. I think that was his first article. That's what I'm leading to.
I was in there. Shout out to Cynthia Horner. Yes, she put me in there.
Yeah, I was going to say, JD, do you remember being in Ride On?
Yeah.
Anyway.
100%.
So I think at the time, was Silk Times Leather your first project or what?
Yes.
How did you get into production?
Well, let me tell you, Silk Times Leather were girlfriends of Houdini, right?
Okay.
So they was out on the tour doing what the girlfriends out on the tour do, basically. And I was on the side of the stage when these girls came up, and I was like, you know, checking them out. I'm young, so I'm checking the girls out. And they was, you know, these was their guys performing. So then we just got to know each other because they was out there like I was out there. And it was like, you know, I'm running around. they running around. So then they pick me up, take me, well, we go to catering or whatever it is, or something that had something to do with touring.
Right.
So long story short, I learned that these girls were from Atlanta. So then it was like, oh, shit. Y'all from Atlanta. And they was like, yeah, so we going back home. When you get back home, call us and we'll come pick you up. We got a car, take you, get something to eat. They was really super nice and this, that, and the third. So when I got back.
Were they your age at the time?
No.
Because I don't even remember Silktimes. No, like, no. So they were older.
Yeah, that's not cool. You don't remember that. No, that's
all, I remember Silktimes.
It's all good.
Stop playing.
It's all good.
I wasn't born then.
Yeah. Oh, whoa. Now,
you were born when Rap City was on. Yeah.
That's when he was born? When it came, when Rap City came on?
Whatever.
All right. So you know, they lived in Atlanta, and basically, at this particular point in time, I was so deep into hip hop, and I was paying attention to everybody's movement. And Herbie Lovebug was moving at this particular point in time. He had Salt-N-Pepa. I think he had just dropped Kid and Play, and Kwame was, you know, he had what I thought I was, you know, what I was looking at trying to figure out.
Movement.
Yeah, movement. So, the girls, they was, you know, they was into Salt-N-Pepa. And some kind of way I found out that they wanted to be rappers or they was rapping or whatever. And out of nowhere, I just said, well, y'all should let me write y'all songs. I don't know what I was thinking about because I ain't had no drum machines or nothing. But I just felt like I could do it. And they was like, okay, well, how you going to do it? And I'm like, we'll figure it out, right? So, and okay. I'm guessing that, I'm thinking that when I said this to them, I didn't think they was going to take me up on it. They called my phone when I got back home, or they called my house, and they was like, we're going to come over your house. So they came over my house, and they got really familiar with my mom and got, you know, really friendly, and my mother trusted them, and I started going out, hanging out with them, and it was all about just hanging out. And then I was always talking about making music. So then I figured out how to call the drummer from Brick, Eddie Irons. He was the drummer for Brick. I called him. He had a studio called 2560 in Atlanta. So I called him. I'm like, yo, I want to make some records. And he was like, okay. What you want to do? And I'm bartering his services.
You made the call?
Yeah. I'm bartering his services. Like, yo.
And you are how old at this point?
I'm 15.
Okay.
Yeah. That's the thing that's amazing me, because there's no one to barter for you.
And you haven't written a song yet either, technically.
Yeah. Well, I did. So ultimately, like, my first song, Shadi wrote my first song.
And this is Shadi?
Yeah, MC Shadi wrote the first song that I ever did. And that... he taught me how to write songs, basically watching him write this song for me. So when he wrote this song, it's called It's Me, that I used to perform on the Fresh Fest. It was a song that he wrote, but he wasn't really saying everything that I wanted to say. So I was in this position where I had this song where I was saying these lyrics that he wrote, but I wanted to say something else. And I wasn't skilled enough to change the lyrics while I was on stage because I thought I was just going to destroy the song.
Right.
So I did the song the way I had learned the song because I wasn't skilled enough to change it. But I knew in my mind I wanted to change the lyrics. So long story short, he got me into writing. So from the Fresh Fest, I came off the Fresh Fest in 86 with us rapping and writing songs, right? So I jumped a piece because I met Chad Elliott, who came in second place to the Fat Boys. In the Disco Fever.
The light-skinned dude?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, you remember Crush Groove?
Yeah.
The skinny light-skinned dude.
So.
He's real?
Oh, my God. Yo.
Where is Chad Elliott now?
He's here. He's in New York. Chad actually is going to induct me into the Songwriters Hall of Fame Thursday.
What?
Yes.
So, wait, he has a...
I'm going to give you all his history.
Yeah,
so,
hit me.
So, you know, Chad, me and Chad, because you said it's nobody I hung out with. So I met Chad later on in the Fresh Fest in like 85. So 84, 85, and 86 was the Fresh Fest. So in 85, I met Chad. They put Charlie Stetler. You know Charles Stetler?
No.
You know Charles Stetler.
Manager,
right? Yeah.
Okay.
Charles Stetler was the Fat Boys manager. He managed Chad. He started managing Chad after the Disco Fever contest. He came to the tour and said, if the Fat Boys stay on this tour, y'all got to put Chad Elliott on this tour because Jermaine's opening. So he made Chad the second opener after me. So it was like, I go, then Chad go. And then people start trying to pit us together, and it never worked. We weren't, you know, we didn't really care about
y'all
that.
Y'all should be a group.
Yeah, well, that didn't happen. We was just like kicking it. And then it was like, we should be a group. So This was like the first version of Crisscross, actually, if you think about it. One dark-skinned, light-skinned kid. So, okay. Fast forward to that, me and Chad really start hanging out. So at the end of the tour, you want to know what happened. At the end of the tour, I moved to Brooklyn with Chad Elliott. So he lives in Brooklyn. I came here to Brooklyn, and I lived almost a year with him in Brooklyn, basically soaking up every bit of hip-hop and New York culture that I could actually get, right? Okay. Every bit of it, everything.
So you were in Brooklyn, 86, 87, 88.
Yeah.
When art...
When everything's art happening. Everything's got... You know, Jay-Z's coming to life in Fort Greene, and Big Daddy Kane's recording demos in Fresh Gordon's house in Fort Greene projects. All of this stuff, I'm right down the street from this and knowing that this is happening, right? So I'm staying in Brooklyn on Nostrand, New York Street,
right,
Eastern Parkway, just for anybody who's listening. Yeah, I was staying over there.
This is 87?
I don't actually know the year, but yeah, it's right after the
Freshman. There's a certain nightclub I want to ask you about, but...
Yeah, I was about to say, cue that up.
I got a cue. Go ahead. Do you have a Latin Quarter story?
No. I don't.
Thank the Lord.
I couldn't get in there. I was too young.
Damn.
I was too young. So Chad actually introduced me to breakbeats and the sound of New York at that particular time. Okay. And that's when my appetite for production and making records came to life. So what happened was I would take breakbeats and I would play the breaks and I would start writing. And I knew that you had to, you know, catch the break and play another one. So right. we had a box and we started
pause taping
and making these beats with break beats. So that's basically how I started. So when I got back to Atlanta, that's the part of the story. That's when I made the call and I'm like, yo, I want to make some records.
You brought breakbeat culture to Atlanta.
Well, I don't think people heard it. That's what made me become more of a producer because I told this guy, sample these beats. I told him, I want this beat to be the song.
What was your weapon of choice back then? Like, what machinery did they have?
I mean, I think he had a, what was it?
SP-12 or?
DMX? A DMX. Okay. That's what he had, right?
Right, yeah.
So you couldn't really sample. So okay. Then I found these white guys across on the other side of town.
Right.
They had an emulator. Emulator could sample.
Yeah.
So I'm like, shit, they could do it with this machine. They didn't want to do it either. They didn't understand what I was saying. They was like, you want us to take people's music? And I'm like, yes, take the beat.
Oh, moral culture.
I'm like, yo, take the beat. I want to rap over this beat. So then they try to recreate the breaks with drum sounds. And I'm like, ew. Like, this is not what I'm talking about. Right? So the frustration of this made me become a producer. So then I just started like, I'm going to figure this out.
See, this is weird. So you're the first person of note that I know that's not from New York that persisted until they found the satisfactory production technique that they knew in their heart they felt was hip-hop. Because usually anyone else that I talk to from other territories, it's just like, okay, well, I'll just do it on the drum machine and you know, 808. No, I got it.
I hate it. Like, when I heard you, I was like, oh, my God, is he for real? Like, this guy understands what I'm talking about. I'd be hating to hear drummers just play beats and it don't sound like what I want it to sound like.
Right.
Like, tune the snare a little bit, make it do something, right? So this was what I was going through. So the frustration that I was going through and not hearing beats the way I wanted forced me to become a producer and start like hitting the drum machines and whatever. So long story short, I got in there and I started getting Eddie to, you know, let me touch the drum machine and give him ideas about the Silk Times Leather record. And I wrote a song called The Woman in Me or something like that. And I think, Work It Out. Work It Out by Silk Times Leather. And we got a deal with Warner Brothers. They got signed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
They was pretty girls. And, you know, I think that's what they was going for more than the music. They didn't really care about the music. They didn't really care about me. But I think they was into the girls and they thought they could sell them based on how they look.
So at what point are the training wheels taking off and then you are like, okay, I can make these beats now? As opposed to sample this and sample that.
Well, Silk Times Leather, I think they sold 15,000 copies. So 15,000 copies to the writer of all the music is like, you know, $15,000 maybe or something. Right. Like, you know. So I took that money and I went and put my drum machine on layaway. And I got a 505 drum machine I put on layaway, right? Because I didn't really have all my money, but I had enough to put the drum machine on layaway. When I got the back end of my money, I went and got the drum machine. So then I start making beats. But the beat still didn't sound like I wanted them. So I was like, okay, I'm just going to make this beat of how I want it to be. When I get to the studio, I'm going to change the sounds. I'm going to have him change the sounds. So I started going to the studio, and I was telling Eddie, changed the sound of the kick. I wanted to sound like this, and I wanted to sound like this. And nobody was getting what I was saying. It's like, okay, all right, this is just killing me. So then I got another check from the Silk Times Leather album that allowed me to get an InSonic EPS.
Ah, okay.
Right? So when I got the InSonic EPS, I thought I had walked into heaven because I could sample and I could do everything that I've been telling everybody else to do. So I just stayed up night after night after night after
night. You taught yourself how to do
this? Yes, I stayed up.
Read the manual?
No, I ain't read nothing. I just...
Never read that, the manual.
No one ever reads the manual on the show.
Yeah, I didn't read nothing. I just started messing with it because I already dreamed that they told me at the store... That what it would do what I wanted. So right. If you tell me it's gonna do what I want, then I'm gonna start trying to do what I want. I seen the sample button, I'm trying to do what I want. And I learned immediately that it didn't do what I want. But you know, that's the learning thing. Yeah, I caught on. So with that, I just started making songs because the EPS was easier and I started making songs and just doing my own little demos. And I met Left Eye, and then she started living with me. And she was
She moved from Philly to Atlanta.
Yeah.
Okay.
So she moved from Philly to Atlanta, and she hooked up with this guy named Ian Burke, who brought her to my house. Now, I didn't have nothing at this time. I just had equipment that I had just bought, and I was working. And he was like, you should go over to JD's house and y'all work. And so she came over to my house. We started working, and we was writing songs basically together. Okay. And then I went to the mall with the DJ from Silk Times Leather.
Okay.
And I saw Criss Cross. And they was in the mall already, just chilling.
So that's a real story.
Real story. Yeah.
Okay. All this time, I thought, oh, that's Mark and his story. Like, there's somebody in this church or whatever.
100% real story. I went to the mall. I'm in the mall shopping, and I'm looking in the corner, and it's these kids that people are actually paying attention to. And I'm like, why are y'all paying so much attention to these kids? And I'm thinking, like, okay, maybe it's like one of these Nickelodeon groups I don't know or something like that.
Right.
So I walk over to them. I'm like, yo, what's up? They like, what's up? I'm saying, like, what do y'all do? They're like, we don't do nothing. We just kick it. And I'm like, y'all just kick it. I'm like, why are the girls like all at y'all? And they like, that's what we do. We got girls. Like, that's what's happening.
How
and it was like,
they
was 11, 12 years old. And I'm like,
and they knew what swag was?
They was the definition of swag to me at that time. I didn't even have that type of swag. I was just trying to be a producer.
Right.
These guys was in the mall flexing, talking to girls, spending money, all kind of things, and getting sneakers. So I was like, damn, where y'all get all this from? Are y'all a group? They're like, nah, we don't rap. We don't do none of that. We just come to the mall. We cool. Oh. Everybody like us because we cool. And I'm like, okay. Immediately, I just stopped, and my mind was like, if I write them a song, this shit is gonna go.
Did they know who Jermaine Dupri was?
No. They thought I was like a pervert or something.
Oh, damn.
I swear. They thought they was like, why do you want my number? Because I asked them for their number. And then luckily, one of their mothers walked up and she read Jet Magazine.
Okay.
So in the Jet Magazine that had just come out, there was like a little issue about article about female rappers, and it had Salt-N-Pepa and the girl groups that are coming behind them. And right. Silk Times Leather happened to be one of those groups. So she recognized the DJ from being in the Jet magazine.
Damn.
So she was like, I know her. I seen her in the Jet. So they are somebody. That saved me because Chris was like, nah, well, I'm not giving you my number. Like you said, it was at OR in Atlanta about the missing and murdered kids. And they was from that neighborhood. So, you know what I mean?
That was a stranger danger.
Yeah, it was a stranger danger, you know, of a situation. So I'm telling them, like, yo, I want y'all to come over to my house and kick it. And they were still like, come over to your house and kick it. What are we doing? Like, because they weren't into music. So they didn't even understand what I was trying to get them to do.
Right.
So, you know, that passed, and I would, like, go get them from school and just try to hang out with them, and I'd become their friend more than just talk about music. So I did that, and then I started noticing that they was in the backseat rapping to music that I was playing. And they was rapping all the lyrics and really doing that shit in the car. Like,
what did they gravitate towards?
Ice Cube. America's Most Wanted. The whole album. I heard Payback's a motherfucker. They was going crazy in my car.
This 11, is weird for me to imagine kids actually gravitating towards shit that I actually like. Because usually, like, the generational divide, kids are always liking the shit that I don't like. You know what I'm saying?
I was about the same age as Criss Cross when they came out. No, hold on. And, like, America's Most Wanted, like, Ice Cube was my shit.
Was unavoidable.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. No, that's what they was, like, Ice Cube fanatics. All they wanted to hear was Ice Cube. So we played a whole Ice Cube tape from their house to my house, and they was rapping all the lyrics. So I was thinking, like, okay, so if they like this, and they rapping every word, and they doing all the inflections, they sound just like he sound when he moves his voice. I said, if I figure out how to do that and write a song for them that they like, they possibly could do the same thing for me. So then I just went in the house and I told him, I said, I'm going to write a song for y'all, and if y'all like it, I need y'all to rap it just like y'all doing this Ice Cube shit. And they was like, okay, whatever. So I did this song where I sampled Michael Jackson and Paul McCartney called The Girl Is Mine, and I was trying to make them fight about The Girl Is Mine, and this was the song that I wrote. And I sampled Paul McCartney and Michael Jackson, and I put Left Eye on the record because she was the girl.
The girl?
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yo, do you have a demo, with this joy?
Look, listen. I will never.
Before you leave this earth, I'm going to find
never,
that shit.
She's rapping on this joint, right?
Like, is she rapping on this joint?
She's the girl. So it's like my idea. Like, The Girl Is Mine. He's Paul McCartney, he's Michael Jackson, and she's the girl. This was my whole little scheme.
Okay, even though you won't let the public ever hear this, do you know where that tape is?
I mean, it's a tape. Yeah, I know it's a tape.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Play that shit for me one. All right, go ahead.
So, you know, that was the beginning. I'm starting to make these songs, and then I realized that they weren't Paul McCartney and Michael Jackson. They were little ice cubes. Like, they were from the southwest side of Atlanta, which people call the Swats. That's where they from.
Yikes.
And they would come home from school and tell me stories about how, Jermaine, you don't even know, this little kids in my school is 11 years old. They selling all the dope. They got all the dope. And they had like socks where they wear shorts and they have like multiple socks and they put all the work inside the socks and they go to school. So they used to give me all this game and I didn't know about because I didn't finish school like that and I didn't go with these kids. So I used to just listen to them and be amazed, like, damn, this is crazy. And I'm like, who knows about this? So then I just start thinking about them rapping Ice Cube and the stories they was telling me. And I'm like, little boys in the hood. This is what y'all are. Y'all are little boys in the hood. There's boys in the hood, but y'all are little boys in the hood. And y'all see the crazy shit that everybody else sees, but don't nobody actually believe it. So that was my goal, to write a song called Little Boys in the Hood. I wrote this song, and I sent the song to Joe the Butcher in Philly. And when I sent the song to Joe the Butcher, he hit me right back like, I love it. Let's sign him. And I was like, what? Oh, shit. We got a deal. Just like that. He was ready to go. So then he brought us to Rough House for basically, it wasn't a real deal. It was a development deal.
Yeah, right.
So it was a 5-song development deal. I didn't have 5 songs. I had 4 songs. And he was like, well, we need 5 songs. So on the night or the day before we was going to Philly, I wrote Jump.
Classics always get written like 10 random, minutes late.
I wrote this song. I wrote this song in 30 minutes.
Yo, every song.
What did it start from? Where did Jump start? Like, what was the first thought in your mind?
Kids. Something.
What did the kids do?
Something kitty, something kitty. So I went after Michael Jackson. Like, he was a kid. They was kids. So he was a kid artist. Sample something Michael Jackson. So I started playing with the turntables, and I heard this ABC, and I was like, I shouldn't let it play all the way out. I should chop it and just catch something. And I don't know what made me do that. And I just caught the first part, boom, 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 and I left it. And I was like, this shit sounds crazy.
I
went back, and I did it again, boom, 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 slow. And I stopped it. And I'm like, I'm not letting the rest of it play. I'm going to just keep doing like that.
Wait, motherfucker, you trying to, wait.
Hold up, because somebody is listening to this podcast right now.
Don't say it.
And they like,
no, don't say it, Laia. Do not say it, Laia.
Wow.
Laia, we all know that's I Want You Back, and I'm sorry.
I mean, well, I said the wrong song. My bad.
I got to say it. Come on, dog. You know that's.
I do now.
I want you back. Yeah, my bad. I said ABC. Oh. I said ABC because I was thinking.
She still didn't know that it was I Want You Back.
Oh, that's what but the wait, whole
this,
thing was.
Yeah, the whole thing was I didn't know that it was a Jackson
listen,
sample.
Here's the shit that's killing me. The shit that's killing me was the whole genius of that song is the fact that you managed to find a way to make Funky Worm.
Oh, shit. Yes.
Match perfectly in key. I mean, look, I love the Bomb Squad to death, but we know their calling card was just throw it on the wall and see what works. They were not atonal and, you know, radical. So when I first heard that shit, I was like, yo, this is some genius shit. Like, how did he know that these shits was going to seem to be in the same BPMs and in the same key? So I'm thinking this whole time you did scientific experiments, but as with every producer that comes on this show, their piece de resistance is always like some afterthought, like 10-minute shit. Like, ah, I got
well, no. Well, the Funky Worm part, I played with it for a minute to get it to sound like that.
Oh, you bend it down to
yeah,
it?
Yeah. I was playing with it for a second.
Thank you. Finally, someone put some thought
into that. That wasn't like, oh, let's go. Because, you know, like I said, you got to think about it. I just explained to you exactly who Criss Cross was.
Yeah.
Criss Cross was two kids from the hood that was in love with the West Coast rappers. Basically Ice Cube at that point in time, right? So the Funky Worm was me grabbing what I thought was the West Coast for them so that they would like it. The sample was me trying to find something that was like Kitty because Michael Jackson was a kid right. in this era. So I was just trying to put all these elements into this one song out of every song. I mean, we already had a deal with Little Boys in the Hood, but I was just like, it could be better than this. And it could be better than this. And I started thinking about every element of hip hop that I could give these kids because I knew that they could rap at this point. Like if they was really rapping what I was doing. For whatever reason I said they could rap, they was rapping whatever I sent them. They would do it. So I was like, shit, let's diss ABC, and let's just go all the way hip hop.
Because Inside Out is
this might be a crazy question, but now that the veil is up and I know now that Criss Cross didn't write their lyrics. Leave me alone.
A surprise
listen,
too.
Leave me alone. A little bit, just not a little bit of a surprise. I thought more of a collaboration. But does that mean the same thing for Another Bad Creation in that way? Like, are you to assume that like Michael Bivins did the same thing?
Dallas Austin did the same. Damn. You were their age at the time. I get it.
The first like child rappers or Bow Wow, the first kid rapper to really start writing their own.
No, stuff. You know, JD wrote everything.
No, he didn't. No, Bow Wow wrote some stuff. Stuff, right?
Come on. Can I get to the science of him as a producer?
Okay, I'm sorry.
That's Captain Obvious question.
Sorry. Sorry.
But listen, but I'm just saying that in terms of who taught you? Because this is the thing. You're the first producer that I've spoken to since the show that is putting marketing savvy also in his production thoughts. Because even me as a producer, I'm certain that there's some, you know, like the equivalent of when you lose your glasses and they're on your forehead. Now I'm thinking like, damn, what obvious shit should the Roots have done to really grab fans of like live music that we didn't do? Because never once in my history did I think of, oh, what's the marketing thing? We need a new Earth, Wind & Fire. Why don't you guys, you know, I've never heard a producer talk like a manager. So what I really want to know is, where did you get your manager marketing savvy from? Because that...
From the doors being closed, right? So when I was here in New York and I had Silk Times Leather, I knew Red Alert and Chuck Chill Out from being on the Fresh Fest. And I knew them as a kid. And then when I started making records, I'm thinking like, yo, I'm going to just run up on here and they're going to play my records. It's cool. I know these guys. So I went up to, you know, to radio shows and Red was like, this shit is whack. Like, this ain't gonna work, JD. And I'm like,
and they told you at the time you're like 15.
It's whack. They told me
they didn't care about your feelings.
And they also was like, Atlanta's not, you know, it's country. Y'all niggas country and blah 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 blah. So I started building this mindset that it was gonna be hard for me to make music anyway, or to put my music out because people weren't gonna listen to it. That's what I just started thinking. So I started thinking about everything that I could possibly do to get people to pay attention to my artists besides the music, as well as the music. So, and then Left Eye was big on helping me do that because she was starting to put this condom over her left eye and just thinking of crazy shit. So I was cutting my eyebrows off and I was doing all, you know, haircuts and earrings and nose. And we was doing everything that we could possibly do to make people pay attention to us, right? So then it was like, we need something else. We got the song. I got Jump. We need something else. When we did Jump, they clothes weren't even on backwards when we did Jump. They didn't have braids. Let me say this. They didn't have braids. On the Jump cover, they don't have braids. Look up, they got flat tops, right? They didn't have braids. So then it was like, we got to take this to another level. We're going to go to the mall. You're going to put your jumper on backwards, and we're going to see how this works. And they was like, why? And I'm like, just listen to me. Put the jumper on backwards. He had a jumper on already. I just said, flip the shit around and let's go to the mall. He put his jumper on backwards, and we went to Lenox Square, and it looked like he had a sign on his chest that said, come towards me. People was walking up to this kid, and I was like, and I just sat back like, oh, this is it. This over. It's over with. This is over with. Because once these people hear this song and they see that they dress like this, we gone. And I don't know what was the attraction with the backwards jeans. It just happened like that.
You don't know what made you go turn it around or do something, not do something else. Like why?
No, I mean, well, we were
trying. Only Chuck D is the only person I knew that spoke of a marketing angle and shit that I never even once bothered to think about.
Yeah, we was trying to do things. We was in the house making tie-dye shirts and tie-dye jeans and just trying to, you know, because when you ain't got shit, you try to make something, right? So that's what it was. We didn't have nothing. So it was like, what can you do to make that sweatshirt look better than what it does right now? Cut the sleeves off. You know, either just try anything, right? So it was just to try to get attention. And
I thought put the word Questlove over it, and that would make it
not
play.
Yeah. His jumper was already 100 sizes too big. It was like a Jabot jumper where you could get in there with him, right? So it's just like, just flip it around.
Just flip it around.
So he flipped it around, and it, you know, people were like bugging out. Like, where did you buy this at? And I'm like, it's the same shit you got on.
But were they fearless enough to be like, any crazy shit, I'll do it?
100%.
Because, see, I would have been like, oh, man, I mean, I'm going to look like a nut.
By the way, they started doing talent shows. I started taking them to do talent shows and performing songs before we had Jump. So they started getting the bug to be artists, and they started seeing how more people liked them than what was liking them in the mall. So once you get that going, then you start trying to make sure that people recognize you.
So how did you feel about when Another Bad Creation was starting to garner steam and, you know, in your head, you were like, okay, this is good for us. Like, we have someone to compare them to. And
Nah. I wasn't really paying too much attention to that at the time because Another Bad Creation is from College Park. We all from College Park.
That's right.
Me and Dallas Austin is like this.
Oh.
Like, that's my dude. Like, so they was all at my house. Like, when he making ABC, I was in the studio with him. We was doing this. Like, we all cool.
So they feel a certain way with Inside Out's Wiggity Wiggity Wack? Or that was insinuated?
At one point, it was like, listen, JD got a little boy group. We got a little boy group. It's a competitiveness going on. So I started feeling that this competitiveness of people talking. So I was like, you know what? Y'all going to be real rappers. And if you're going to be a real rapper, we're going to make sure that people know that they want to be an R&B group and y'all are real rappers. And that's the only way we can make people understand that was to say something about them.
So at this point, how are you splitting up your brain? Because you said that you and Left Eye or y'all are friends. She just got to the condom in the eye. And where is where's the TLC bus?
They're there too.
Why didn't
so,
you?
No. Listen. So, at the same time that I'm making Crisscross, Ian introduces Left Eye to T-Boz. So then they become a group in my house called Second Nature, and they become my group. And the way T-Boz sings is the Jermaine Dupri style of singing, like. The way she sounds, reason why she sounds, that's me.
Because you demoed
you
the songs.
You can hear me.
First,
that's me doing that now. That's how she sounds because I demoed the songs and I told her she should sing like me.
Oh, man. And for the rest of her life.
I mean, it became the
cool. That was her thing.
It just became the cool thing for her. So the first song that I did for her was this song called I Got It Going On. And it was like, I got it going on. And that's the tone that she took. And Dallas heard that and started making these TLC records, and they used that tone for the rest of their career.
But why didn't you
sign them?
Yeah, or
because the boys got signed first, right? So I was more connected to Crisscross and more into their project. Right. And then Left Eye called me one day and she was like, "Yo, we just had this meeting with Pebbles. If y'all watch the VH1 movie, she makes this phone call and she calls somebody, but they don't say it's me,
right?"
She's calling me, and she's calling me to see if I'm cool with them having the meeting, right? And I said, yeah, go ahead, have the meeting. I'm cool. At that point, I wasn't thinking about having all of the artists under my umbrella. I was thinking about them getting signed so I could get some more money to make records. So I was like, shit, if they're going to sign you, just make sure I produce you and I get some money.
Right.
So I encouraged them to get signed to LaFace. And, you know, that was my group walking out the door. But they all started at my house.
I believe my internship at Rough House was the first day that you guys went to Europe to open up for Michael Jackson. Cause I know that Crisscross opened up for Michael Jackson on the Dangerous Tour then.
Yes.
So what was, were you a part of their setup?
100%.
What was that shit like? And how could, like, were the audiences as familiar with you guys there as it was in the States?
Totally. Jump was crazy over there. Being on tour with Michael Jackson was just like nothing that you could ever imagine. You know what I mean? It's like the way this guy came into his shows, just the whole setup of the whole shit. Like, say for instance, this was like the cafeteria area when you're eating, right? And you know how cafeterias are when you're in tour. It's the open or it's a place that you go into. Well, on his tour, it was always an open space. They did it in an open space. They didn't do it inside a thing. Because he wanted everybody to see when he was coming in and how they draped us off so we wouldn't see him where he went. So it was like, yeah, like they would like, he's coming.
So if you sit in whole room.
So they would trap y'all inside
so
of
So you're her. Sitting there knowing that he's going, that he's walking by. But you could see him on the way in because he had a police following him. He would do this. It was real shit. He would come in and then he'll cross and then he would, you know, he'd tell the managers, yo, tell Krishna I'm in the, you know, I'm in my dressing room. Come holler at me, whatever, before they, whatever. So he never let me go because it was just like, you know, not too many people go in the dressing right. room. So Krishna, they'd go back there and kick it with him and they'd come back and they'd be like, yo, he fucking with us. Like, he really be like, he know who we are, da, 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 da. Because that's what I was always trying to figure out. If Sony made the move because everybody was on Sony to put Criss Cross on there, he was really more like really focused on Criss Cross being on his tour. And he liked the fact that they was young and they had that energy to give before his show came on.
Was it easy to teach them like things that you don't learn? You know, I mean, they're in stadiums and soccer stadiums. I know he's playing like 85,000 people. Like, how do you teach them how to project to 85,000 people? Like,
well, that's what I tell people all the time. You know, I got this TV show, The Rap Game, where I teach these kids. And I try to tell these kids all the time, like, everybody think they can rap. And everybody think they got this swag. But they ain't really got that shit, like what I've seen. Criss Cross, like I said, when I met them, they had a swag that I had never seen in 11 and 12-year-olds. So they was instantly easy to grab on to what they were supposed to do to continue to have that swag that they thought they had before. So when their record blew up, they was doing shows every day. Criss Cross was like the first rap group to do KML Summer Jam, then catch a helicopter to do Power 106 in the same day, and then get on a plane and come back to New York and do something the next day. Like, that's how they was performing because of that song. So they got the practice in, and they got enough practice in to know that when we get out here, we can really go on tour and do stadiums. Their mentality was, we going to kill this, and they just was into it.
Was it overwhelming for them? Like, it's to start at that level. Like, how do you come down from that level when you're, you know, one of the – I'm certain that you didn't have any idea that this shit was going to sell, like, 7-8 million units.
Yeah, you don't know what to do. You just going with the flow. You know, it's it was a thing that wasn't even supposed to happen. And I've learned that these kids could rap and they did it and it just turned into that. And you just like sitting back watching like, this is crazy.
And it wasn't hard to keep them focused at all on.
Nah, I mean, because like I said, once again, once they realized that they was rappers and people was looking at them like this, they were so into it. I didn't have any problem. They was so, their appetite was worse than mine.
So it was through them that you got to develop your label, which
yeah, so Criss Cross sold 8 million, and then Sony wanted to do more business with me,
right?
And they wanted me to have my own label, and they wanted to see what I could bring. They didn't know I was 19 years old, by the way. They didn't know what I could do.
So, what did you see in Escape that told you, okay, you guys are next? I see how I can.
Well, Escape came to my house. The same guy Ian who brought left out of my house, he brought Escape to my house to sing for my birthday. And they was this girl group from College Park that was out there doing things. And they came and they sung Happy Birthday to me. And I was just like, y'all sound different than regular Happy Birthday than I'm usually here. I'm liking this Happy Birthday, right? So
right.
I'm like, when I get my label, I'm going to sign y'all. And they was like, yeah, okay, whatever. I ain't have So So Def. I just told them I was going to do it. Same thing I did with Sometimes Love. I just said I'm going to do it. I ain't have no label yet, but I knew I was going to get one because we selling too many records. Right. So they came, and like I got my deal, and I called in. I said, yo, I want to sign these girls. And at that point, I knew that I had to define myself as a producer because that's what I wanted people to pay attention to me as. As a producer, you have to show people that you have the skill to do more than what people thought you could do as, you know, just rap music or whatever, this, that, and the third. And I had all of this other musical talent inside my body that I hadn't let out on the Crisscross record. And I signed Escape and I started writing their songs. And the first song I wrote for them was just Kicking It. And I, you know, and I made Candy sing just like I made T-Boss sing. That's why she's low in that song. Right. And, you know, it was the same. I had already been setting myself up for this type of stuff. So I just was sending whoever came in through the same process that I had already started earlier.
Now, I mean, around 93, 94, 95, I mean, we're getting into what I feel like the business element of hip hop, mm-hmm. where now Bad Boy's developing, Death Row's developing. But then there's also like kind of we're entering the danger zone. Like it's not, well, I mean, you've been around shit since you was 12. So I'm sure you saw some dark shit that, you know,
yeah,
a 12-year-old shouldn't be seeing. But
I mean, I've seen people get stabbed after midnight.
In Philly. Yeah. Oh, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I mean,
now the Spaghetti Factory line. Oh,
okay, got to.
I said a lot of shit. Yeah.
I wasn't born yet.
It was on Spring Garden. Spring Garden.
Whoa. Okay.
Anyway, but it's at least at that time in '94. I considered okay. Now the business mecca to be New York, which is Puffy, L.A., which is Shook, and Atlanta, which is you. And okay, I'll throw in Houston. Which, of course, because I fear for my life, Jay Prince. So now that you're your empire, how do you deal with the, not the muscle aspect, but now you're playing with the big dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And you see what's going on rivalry-wise and all that stuff. You kind of been Switzerland with all this stuff as far as neutral.
Yeah.
You've been cool with New York Cats. You've been cool with LA. How hard was it to maneuver, you know, through what was developing in hip hop at the time in 93, 94,
well, it wasn't for me because I felt like, you know, I started out on the Fresh Fest. So I started out with everybody being my friend. So that was my mentality. So like when Puff started doing parties here in New York, I heard about him. I come to New York and come to Puff parties and see what it was. I wanted to be around all my competition and see what they was doing. So I came to New York. I became Puff's friend. We caught hanging out. I go to his parties, party kick and see how he's throwing parties. And I go back to Atlanta, I throw my parties, right? And then once I would come back to Atlanta and throw my parties, I would say like, yo, I met these guys. I need to call them down to Atlanta and come, you know, come party where I'm, what I'm doing, right? And they, I think my non-interest in what they was doing was interesting to them. Like I wasn't interested in whatever they was doing, that was cool. I was still trying to do what I was doing. You know what I'm saying? So like when all the artists or record labels was doing rap, I went and did an R&B album. So they couldn't follow. I didn't have no pattern that everybody was going on. I was going through, like when I did Escape, nobody else was making R&B, you know, R&B groups. Everybody wanted to rap, right? So then when I did the Brat, nobody weren't fucking with female rappers. They was all trying to do guys. And it was like, so I just kept seeing this like, oh, I'm going to maneuver like this. I'm going to do something different. So long story short, I saw that as my place. I saw these guys just trying to fight for the same space. And I'm like, shit, I'm cool. I'm getting my money. I'm doing what I'm doing in my own space. And I'm going to just be cool with them. I didn't even know like how serious this East Coast, West Coast thing was getting. So I invited both Puff and Shug to my birthday party in Atlanta. And not thinking about anything, like, you know, just come. I want y'all to be there. I want to have that flavor in Atlanta and at my birthday party.
What year is this?
I don't know the year. Well, it has to be 94.
Somewhere around
before the shit starts hitting the fan.
Well, this is when it hit the fan.
This is when it hit fans.
Wait a minute. That was your birthday party?
Yeah, it was my birthday
party. I remember
party.
I was in college. Because
they depicted
like
it in the movie, but they never said
it was my birthday party when the shit hit the fan.
Yeah. I didn't even know.
Yeah. I didn't realize that was happening, but they both were brought to Atlanta by me, and they came to Atlanta, and, you know, they were eyeing each other throughout the party, and it was like a thing, but I'm thinking, you know, that's how hip-hop is. And then it got to, after my party, went to an after party, and you know, words were said and somebody got killed.
Y'all, I didn't even know.
Yeah.
Okay, that's Questlove Supreme, ladies.
Wait.
So now, check, please. Now I'm like trying to figure out where, like, where does the Brat's the B side fit into this?
Okay, so there's so many stories, but all right, so when, like I said, me and Puff was cool throughout this whole period of making music, and at this time, Funkdafied came out, and it was three hot records that came out. One was Super Hot, which was Flavor in Your Ear.
Right.
The second one was Funkdafied with me and the Brat. And then the third was Juicy for all the hip-hop people. That it wasn't a successful record like Funkdafied and Flavor in Your Ear. So Big was
all the same year.
Big was so frustrated with the fact that we was having success and Flavor in Your Ear was killing him and he was coming on stage and people weren't really like understanding who they was looking at. So then Big thought, I'm going to get cool with JD and I'm going to get him to make me a beat. So every day, we went on this tour. We went on a Chitlin' Circuit tour where it was just these three artists, the Brat, Craig Mack, and Biggie. And we went all around the little Chitlin' Circuit and did all these shows. So in that time period, me and Biggie became really cool. And he talked to me all the time about how you get Honey popping like that? Like, why people don't like my record? Like, he used to ask me all kind of crazy questions. Like,
He was under the impression that
nobody
Juicy
liked him.
Was...
Nobody, like, because we was in the South. By the way, this is not New York. This is the right. South. We was in Florida. We was doing... In Atlanta, Juicy wasn't nothing.
You serious?
Nothing.
But the numbers. So that was all New York? That's all Northeast?
All Northeast.
Atlanta had his own shit.
That's crazy. Because even culturally, I would think that when the smoke clears...
Mm-mm.
Juicy sort of inched. Everybody freestyled over Flavor in Your Ear, but I feel like Juicy's the more iconic.
It is, but it was like it took forever.
Biggie had to die too.
It wasn't that. It just had to be worked. It was just, you know, it was the beginning of working your rap records.
That was
working.
A hard sell?
Yeah, it was a hard sell.
Working your
The
rap.
Juicy record was a hard sell for the other areas like the South. You know what I mean? It's almost
other places
like,
not the Northeast.
So you know, Biggie was like, yo, you know, make me a record. Do something for me, man. Let me do something for me. So he asked me so many times that once they released Big Papa, he wanted me to do the remix of Big Papa. So told Puff, yo, JD's doing the remix of Big Papa because he didn't believe in the success of Big Papa. He didn't think it was going to work. He thought they was going to have to put out the JD version.
In Indiana, where I grew up, that's the version we heard on the radio all the time.
See what I'm saying?
The JD remix.
Damn. With those... Goddamn high.
All right, so when Biggie came to do, Biggie said, yo, I want to do a real remix. I want you to redo the beat. I don't want to rap over this. I want you to let's do a real remix. So he wanted to actually make a new song. In his mind, he was like, yo, I'm going to go to Atlanta. I'm going to make a new record, and it's going to relaunch my career. So when he came to Atlanta, I said, we're going to re-vocal Big Papa. I'm going to give you a beat, and you can do the rap over. So I made the beat, and he rapped the song over. When he finished the rapping, because he rapped the song so fast and he was done so quick, when he finished, he's like, let's make another song. And he was like, where Honey at? And I'm like, who you talking about? He was like, Brat, where she at? Get her over here.
Get over here real quick, man.
Brat actually lived upstairs in my mother's house, so she was upstairs, and he ain't know. So I was like, she upstairs, I tell her come down. So he came downstairs. He was like, yo, I want to do a song with Honey, man. Make a record. I'm going to do a song with Honey. I'm like, all right, let's do it. So I was just like, I know what he want. I was just trying to think of, like, what would be a jump fast record for Biggie if I could give him that record. And I wanted to give him a loop. I wasn't trying to just make a beat. I was like, we're going to sample something. You know, we're going to figure it out. And I put up the outstanding beat, the loop, and I was like, rap over this. And, you know, this guy's incredible. He made that beat sound like it had a bass line on it before I even put the bass line on there.
Right.
So then I was just like, he was like, Brat, you gonna come in after me. So he started making the song, and I'm trying to make the beat at the same time while he's rapping. And this song just happened. That's why we don't have no title. It's called the B-side. It was just like, what's the name of this song? We don't fuck that. Just rap. And it was like, that's how the song came about. So,
man. All right, so okay, I'm skipping a little bit because I know we got limited time. But even though, I mean, you're associated with many artists, I always feel like your crowning achievement as a producer was working with Usher.
Thank you.
Yeah. And first of all, how does that happen? Because you spearheading, like, how do you take the little kid who did Just Call Me a Mech, and how did you take him and fully develop him into the artist, as far as like choosing his songs, and like, what was it that?
It's basically the same situation that I had already been through, right? I started Usher came to me when Criss Cross was popping, and he asked me to sign him. I told him no, because I was tired of dealing with parents at this particular point, because Criss Cross was getting big and their parents was like arguing and fighting. It was all the parents, and I'm like, I'm not dealing with this shit no more. I don't want no kid rappers. I mean, kid artists. So I passed on signing Usher, and then LaFace signed Usher.
Right.
So then that Call Me a Mac album didn't really, really work, but everybody felt like Jermaine could revive your career if you go do a remix. So they brought me, what's the song?
Think of You, wasn't it?
Think of You.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
So they brought me Think of You, and they said, Jermaine, please do a remix to Think of You. So I did a remix to Think of You, and in the midst of that, I felt like the song needed a bridge, because I was just trying to figure out some way to make my remix feel different than the record. So I added a bridge to the song, and I told Usher he had to come in and sing the bridge over. So when he came in, he sung the bridge that I had written for him, and he sung it just like I had him, like I did it. And then they heard his vocals, and they was like, oh, shit, what did you do to him? And I'm like, I just told him to sing the bridge. And they was like, well, would you work on his next album? Like, just take him and do whatever the hell you want to do with him. And I'm like, that sounds crazy. But okay. And I didn't know what to do. You know what I mean? I didn't know. They just put it in my hands. And I found out that if it didn't work with me, Usher would have probably got dropped. Right? So
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, Usher came to my house and he became like a so-so deaf artist. He basically stayed in my house every night, and we just talked and worked and talked and worked and talked and worked until we got to my way.
But what's the process of you getting these songs out of them? Because, I mean, these aren't like average songs. These are like staples. You Make Me Wanna and all that stuff. Like, how did you, what's your process of getting to know the artist and what type of song's the right song and who?
I mean, well, I went through a bunch of records. I've started making songs that I thought were like, I don't even know what you could call the first songs, but I know that he said, yo, I don't want to be like that. I want to be like Bobby Brown. I want Bobby Brown to fear me. So then I started looking at my prerogative.
Check.
So I started looking at my prerogative, and I'm like, okay, well, I'm thinking, like, I can't make no harder record than my prerogative. This shit is crazy. And Teddy Riley's my idol, so I can't make a better record than my prerogative. So I was just trying to make records that I felt like would go to bat with these songs, at least, right? So I made Nice and Slow, and I played it for L.A., and he didn't like that song. And I'm like, how you don't like this song? And I'm like, nobody's doing this. Nobody's doing it. You hear how Usher singing, 7 o'clock on the dot. I'm in my top. He was in the streets. I'm saying, who you know talking like this as an R&B artist? They weren't getting none of that shit. So that song was, like, put to the side. So then Usher was like, man, I need something like prerogative. This is my, I want this shit my way. And I was like, oh, my way. Okay, let's do that. Let's do it your way. And we start making My Way. And then we got to My Way. My Way was probably going to be the first single. I didn't have You Make Me Wanna. And My Way is probably going to be the first single. And I wrote him a rap. He was rapping. It just felt like it was like the new sound for Usher. But I still wasn't convinced. I wasn't sold yet. I was like, they ain't like Nice and Slow. And I was on the Nice and Slow shit. I was trying to get that off. Like, the singing rap type singing, right? And they wasn't really sold on it. So, L.A. was like, we gonna put out My Way as the first single. And when he told me that, I left the office and I went home and I started making You Make Me Wanna. And I was like, I just felt like he didn't have that one yet. He didn't have that one. So I started making You Make Me Wanna, and I wrote the first verse, and I had the hook, and I played it for Usher, and he was like, man, it's all right. That ain't really what I'm talking about. Because he wanted the My Way. He wanted the prerogative.
Some hard drive.
You know, he wanted that. So I was like, I said, you tripping. So I left, and I took the song back to LaFace, and I played the song for L.A., and he was like, yo, go finish that song right now. That's it. So I went back to the studio and I finished You Make Me Wanna, and I got Usher on the song, and he sung the song like he loved it, and the rest is history.
How often do you have to browbeat your artist when it comes to vocals?
Bribe them?
No, browbeat. I'm sorry. I've made it known on the show that the one process of production I hate the most is vocal takes. Mm. I hate that shit. So usually I have someone else
do it
because I don't have a good chemistry. Yeah, I don't have the patience
to do it. Yeah.
So how do you? And especially at the time, I mean, Pro Tools was a thing here and there, but you weren't early mid '90s. You were literally working this.
Well, see, my thing is this: you know, if you can really sing and you understand music, and you listen to my demo, then automatically it's gonna sound better than what I'm listening to anyway, or what I'm thinking anyway. Right, so that's how I make my records. I'm like, listen to me first and do exactly what I'm doing, but do it the way you would do it in your real singing voice. So most of the time when they do that, that shit starts to sound way better than what I'm thinking.
So for every hit that you have
that I wrote,
there's a Jermaine Dupri version
100%,
of it out there.
100%.
Oh, it's gonna be Prince time when you pass away.
So I mean, I did this last like 2 weeks That'd ago, or 3 weeks ago at the ASCAP convention in LA. And it was like, go under the hood of Confessions. And I gave them basically a snap look at how I wrote that song and how the song came about and let them, you know, listen to me actually sing the song like that.
Wow. That's interesting. I would love to hear that. not just because it's interesting. Like I was the type of kid that took all my toys apart because I wanted to see how they worked.
Yeah.
So like to be able to hear your demo of a song like Nice and Slow or something like that, it's fascinating to me.
Yeah, it's bad, but you know it's good.
Plus, to hear you sing.
But it's still you could. But if I heard it, I could still hear how.
Yeah,
how
I mean,
it went from that to the version that we all know.
Yeah, 100%. And that's what when you introduced me, you said I don't get the credit. I feel like people don't really understand that those Usher records is why Trey Songz sound the way he sounded and the way Chris Brown started singing the way he sang. These records created that sound.
Yeah, it was definitely the template for it. I know that also Mariah came to you at a crucial point in her career.
No. Before that,
Not a crucial point?
No, I did Always Be My Baby.
That's what I'm talking about.
That wasn't crucial. She was...
No,
huge.
But the thing with 95, you got to understand, though, like, Always Be My Baby and Fantasy Remix, that was a very radical turn for her, at least from the tutelage that she was under with Tommy Mottola, with making sure that, I mean, okay, like, you know, Dream Lover had the breakbeat and all that stuff. It was cute, but it was still, like, it was in major key. Like, it wouldn't start no riot at no mall in America.
No, not at all.
But at least with 1995, with her insisting, like, yo, I'm trying to make some shit that, like, I would listen to in a club. Like, her going to Wu-Tang and Puffy and going to you,
mm-hmm.
It's like, that was, in my eyes, radical. Which, you know, getting the record and being a connoisseur of credits, I'm like, oh. They're loosening the reins on her. They're letting her work with us.
Yeah,
and that sort of thing.
I get it.
So, first of all, in working with her, was it a thing of like you getting instructions like, don't go too hardcore? Don't, you know, we already have one Wu-Tang song. Like, just try to give her.
No, we had this conversation last night. I'm the musical person when it comes to Mariah Carey. She's the rapper. It completely a flip when we go in the studio. We had this same conversation last night.
Oh, so you're the conservative one and she's the one that wants to...
Yeah, because I'm trying to protect who she is at all times because I feel like, you know, she has an image that you can, you know, if you can keep it in this space, mm-hmm. You ain't got to go overboard. You could just keep it in this space and put, like you just said, she had a loop, but it wasn't get people killed. It was still what we liked, but it was not crazy. And I'm always like, let's make records like that. Like, let's continue the 17 million, 20 million spot. I'm cool. What's wrong with that? It was never broken. Let's do it. Ariana Grande came out and, like, that's basically what she wants to do. So it's like, Mariah's a rapper, 100%. The first day I worked with Mariah came to the studio and she brought Cream and she said, I wanted to sing over this. I want you to sample this. And I said.
So how are you like, dial it back a little bit?
And I'm like, what? And Tommy Mottola was standing there when she did this, and I'm thinking, like you said, I'm like, nah, I'm not fucking with this Cream shit. That's not gonna happen. I'm not doing
really?
This. Yeah, 100%.
That actually sounds like
that
might
work, the fear of you didn't want to be
the guy that fucked up her career?
Yeah,
I knew because that would have been a great idea.
100%. At the time when she asked me to do it, it would have made it amazing.
But you didn't want to be the guy holding the this fell apart.
And I like I said, I have a super musical side of me. Right. When I start doing R&B records, I turn into a very musical person that wants to hear a lot of different chords and different things and the way the song is supposed to go. So, and I had just did, you know, Usher. So it was R&B time for me. Right. So I was like, I need something that fits into what I just did with Usher. I'm having success here. Let's do something that has this feel. So then Emmanuel started playing the boom, doom, 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 doom. And I'm like, see, if we put some 808 on that shit, it's over with. That's how I believe in 808 on anything, and that's it.
So by this period, okay, now I'm using a Fonte term. What's the division of labor as far as who is in your team, your production team, as far as, okay, it's 1997, and I'm Mariah Carey. I want to get it. Make sure that, you know, I'm Mariah Carey. Okay, I work with Mariah Carey. I'm like, yo, produce a record. What is Team Dupree? Like, what's going on? What's the songwriting session?
Me and Emmanuel Seale.
So what's the songwriting session like?
He's...
Like, do you have something ahead of time, or is it like real time?
Yeah, we just work right off the cuff. He's an extra keyboard player, guitar player. You know, he plays instruments, and... I play what I play, and then I make the beats, and I have the ideas basically, and I write the lyrics basically. However, you know, if with Usher, that's how it was. It was me and him, and we basically did the song, that whole album like that. And then we went to Mariah. It was me and Emmanuel, and we made "Always Be My Baby."
Do you engineer or mix your own records as well?
Nah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I do it. You know, I do my rough before it goes, but I don't touch that.
Amir mentioned 1997, and I feel like with Atlanta, something happened between like 96 and, I don't know, 99, where, of course, starting with you, the music industry just built faster than any other industry in most major cities. Mm-hmm. Can you kind of...
Not Freaknik or Jack the Rapper?
Well, you got to consider all those things. Like, conferences were coming. You did have Freaknik, but like... It just was a crazy, like, 5 years in Atlanta, and I don't know if everybody understands how it broke down and whatnot.
I mean, well, like you said, it was Freaknik. It was things that weren't happening in other major cities that people were, like, looking like.
And post-Olympics.
Like, so what point was Atlanta seen as, you know, because I know that Northeastern people are very cocky and whatever, like, oh, you countrified. Well, suddenly, Atlanta's the shit. Mm-hmm. Like, when do you feel that Atlanta, like, arrived, like,
when I was having parties and everybody started coming. If Jermaine Dupri have a party, everybody was going to Atlanta for the party. Freaknik was the start of this, but then I started, you know, I did this How Can I Live weekend where
your version of the NWA pool party.
Nah. Matter of fact, it wasn't, my thing was called Can I Live, right? Because I had just did the Money Anything record, and
right,
what was interesting, what I was getting back, was that people felt like in the South, I introduced them to Jay-Z, right? Because people in the South weren't listening to Reasonable Doubt. You know, that wasn't their album. They weren't into none of those records in Atlanta. None of that was happening. So people was like, they felt like I was introducing them to them, and Jay and everybody was coming to Atlanta, you know, taking this love.
Yeah,
and
people come to you to... some love elsewhere besides the North.
Yeah, so that's what happened. So I think people started paying attention to this, like this momentum. You know, Mace came to Atlanta for my birthday party to get signed. Nelly came to Atlanta to try to get me to sign him at my birthday party. I had this crazy birthday party at the High Museum on Peachtree. And I had all of those guys there. I had New Edition there. I had Maya, Elton John. Everybody was, you know, whoever was... Somebody was trying to be at Jermaine Dupri party, and people were like, I remember like yesterday, even the paper, it said, what does Jermaine Dupri have that's making everybody want, like, Elton John, what do you have a reason to be around BBD and Maya and Jermaine Dupri? What's the purpose? What's the connection?
I'm trying to imagine that conversation right now.
Elton John is cool.
He loves black music.
He loves black music.
I know that, but still, it's just an odd pairing.
Yeah, well, I mean, he wanted me to know he was cool and he came to party. But that, I think that's what it was, what you're talking about. It was just like, people saw that happening, and it was just like I said, I wasn't paying attention to everybody else. Whatever people was doing in New York, that's what they was doing in New York. I was determined to make Atlanta stand out just like New York and L.A. Like,
but, see, then there was a point when Atlanta started taking in this and pushing its chest out with pride to the point where, like, it wasn't so much the Northeast record would get played first. Now Atlanta is supporting each other on the radio, and it's records that you would never hear in other places. 100%. And things. Yeah. And I just think that people don't really understand that about Atlanta in that way. Like, I always say that about, like, somebody like Rashida. Like, Rashida is a star in Atlanta because of Atlanta and Atlanta radio and everybody embracing her when she was emceeing.
Yeah, I mean, it was a tug of war type of mentality because people weren't really receptive of things that was coming from Atlanta like that. Almost to the point where Jermaine Dupri was getting the success, so a lot of people in Atlanta was mad at me because I was getting success that a lot of them weren't getting at the same time. So it was like they didn't understand why my records was working. So then I've heard people say crazy shit about my records, and you know, JD ain't from Atlanta, and I don't sound like Outkast, and this, that, and the third. Like, it was, but my childhood and my life was different than that. I didn't grow up in Atlanta. I grew up on tour.
So can you explain? Can you explain the science of what would be now known as trap culture? Because initially, I thought that you guys were more of a refined. What was supposed to be Miami's identification of bass music, I always felt that you guys were a more refined bass music. Like, you guys did better work with those type of planet rock beats and 808 stuff.
100%.
You know? And then trap culture develops.
Yeah.
How do you feel, like, are you in your heart the old, I know you're technically not supposed to agree with this, like, are you the old schooler that's sort of looking like, okay, whatever? Or, like, are you still about, like, if kids are about it, then that's the future and I support it and that sort of thing?
Well, I mean, it's hard for me to even talk about this because if you listen to Jermaine Dupri records that are, like, some non-so-so deaf artist records, the records are trap. Like, if you listen to Grills by Nelly.
Okay.
This was before people start saying trap records. But it's by Nelly, and it became a number one top 100 record, and it's not connected to the trap, so it don't come off like that's what that is. But the sound of the record is 100%. Boom, boom. It's all the same elements. You know, the 808 is overbearing. The small little kick. The Franchise Boys, Bone Crusher, Young Bloods, all of this shit is what you're basically listening to now. So to me, I think people disconnect me from being with that sound, but that's been the sound. Like, You Make Me Wanna, to me, sounds like a trap record to me with guitars on it, right?
It's definitely a precursor to trap music.
Yeah. So I look at it as like people were listening to that sound and they just decided what to do. I also feel like trap music ultimately, I don't like that title because I think people use that title to let us in as opposed to just saying it's the Atlanta sound. I wish people would stop calling it trap and say Atlanta music like they say everybody else. That's that LA sound. That's that New York sound. That's that Atlanta sound. Stop saying trap because trap puts it in a box and it's like, okay, yeah, you got a trap set. No, this is 2 hours of Atlanta music. Music from all of the artists in Atlanta. You go to New York right now, you're going to hear 2 hours of records from Atlanta. Stop saying trap. That's what I wish people would do.
So what do you feel now is the future? Like, are you done with Atlanta or is it just starting? Like, for you, is there more to reveal to the world as far as what your next move is going to be? I don't know, as executive or?
I mean, you have to continue to keep finding ways to open the doors for Atlanta. So I got the TV show, and you know, with the TV show, I bring 5 kids to Atlanta and expose them to what kids in Atlanta are exposed to. Kids in Atlanta have it better than mostly every other city kids out here, period. Like, in Brooklyn, I don't think they have talent shows for kids where kids can do things. I don't think they have skating rinks where they allow you to perform. I don't think they have... It just, when you want to be an entertainer in Atlanta, we have more elements than, you know, I find out because these kids come and they like, yo, we don't have nothing. Like, one of the kids came from Chicago and she was talking about how they close the skating rinks and kids don't really have anything to do, right? in Atlanta, the kids got, they can go to things and perform and people see them and do, there's so many different outlets that people are opening that we already had.
Y'all
so
keep
so
it
roller
blue.
Skating culture is still
keep
a thing?
100%. Wednesday, every Wednesday, every Monday, every Sunday, this is going on.
Wow.
And so with all of this stuff going on, I'm still pushing Atlanta culture. I think that that's the most, you know, that's the most important thing. And I still feel like Atlanta's yet to have their Kendrick Lamar or their J. Cole or their Jay-Z yet in this era. We had it prior.
Right. I was going to say.
No. I'm saying we had it prior. I'm just saying. I'm saying in this era. This era, it feels like, you know, it's a new artist
still
every week.
Okay.
Right? It feels like it's a new hot artist every week. So I'm just saying, I still feel like the city is so hot that one of these rappers that people look at as a problem rapper, because like I said, they label everything in Atlanta so much as trap that they don't fear anything.
Right.
You know what I mean? If you say, oh, he's just, that's just trap. So it don't ever get into the box of, oh shit, you know, this guy, you know what I'm saying? It's never that.
Well, who do you feel that's unbeknownst to us, but who do you feel that's bubbling under that's going to make an impact right now? Like, what artists do you feel that are?
I mean, it's a lot of underground artists in Atlanta that really rap that could possibly do this. I felt like Sahai was going to be that guy for a second. You know, he's with the right crew and he understands what I'm talking about. Like, if a lot of people might not even know that Sahai's from Atlanta.
I didn't know that.
I figured he was a Chicago guy.
Yeah. I thought he was Chicago.
Yeah. Nah, he's from the east side of Atlanta and he raps.
Shit, I didn't know that Kanye was from Atlanta.
Oh. Yeah, he was from Atlanta too. So, I mean, you know, like I said, it's we still got room. Because of how people put it in the box. If people open up the box and do what I'm doing, then it might be a little different. But I'm saying I wish people would stop that, because I think trap, the word trap music came from EDM DJs wanting the ability to play rap music in their sets.
And not call it
not call it rap music.
Let me ask you.
We're talking about Diplo. Wait.
Oh.
Can I override?
Yes, it's your
name. What did I do? Did I push open the trap?
No.
It's never a battle, boss. It's never a battle.
I'm about to rain on parade.
Uh-oh.
How happy are you to do an interview in which no one has to ask you any Janet Jackson questions?
It's not over.
Yes, it is. That's why
I had Lil Jon questions, so that wasn't even okay.
All right. I want to be the first.
Let me say this. I don't look at any of that as a problem, because my life is not regular, mm-mm. Right? And if you don't understand that your life is not regular, then you won't be celebrating your life the way you're supposed to, right?
Right.
I had a girl tell me, like, nigga, do you even know that? I don't know another person that's dated Janet Jackson. Like, this is what the girl told me, right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm listening to her. I'm like, and I'm listening to her in a not paying attention to what she's saying mindset. But then it hit me, like, that's what people actually think. So if you don't ask me the question, then it wasn't something that resonated in your life. But I'm saying,
but
after Janet
one
Jackson
point, it becomes an obsession, and it overshadows your history.
But I'm saying she's such a cultural staple in our culture. That is hard for people to ignore it, right? So I understand it. It's not something that, you know, it is what it is.
Okay, we'll ask one question. What was it like meeting the family? Like, was...
You have never heard me say about this before?
No,
it was
I've
the
not.
Most shocking... I want to say shocking moment, but it shouldn't be shocking, because their last name is Jackson.
Oh, they black. They black.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Black.
And they from Gary, Indiana.
And it's five brothers... to the girl that I was dating. Six.
Ooh, Randy almost kicked your butt.
Niggas, by the way, right? So
I
remember
that.
Like the first time I went to their house, and I think it was Jackie. And Jackie told me, you know, I might probably shouldn't be saying this, but Jackie said, JD, you gotta understand what life was like being a Jackson.
I had to.
He said, we was the only... And everybody listen to what I'm saying. We was the only niggas in California with Ferraris. In California.
Yeah.
Just so you understand what I'm saying.
The state.
Yes.
The only niggas in that city, in L.A., driving Ferraris.
Yeah.
And he went on to let me know, you know, they fucked everybody, basically. And, you know, this it's like, and one of the conversations I had with her was that she told me when we first started dating is that, just understand I've seen everything. It's nothing that you can get away with. It's nothing that you can tell me that I haven't heard. I've hidden girls under my bed for my brothers because their girlfriend was downstairs. Like, it's crazy shit that, you know. So when you meet this family, you think about them from entertainers, but they are just as normal as we are, and if not more ghetto and country.
They're from Gary, Indiana. 100%. I know exactly how they are.
100%.
Did you ever remind Michael that he didn't talk to you on that tour when it was with Criss Cross?
Nah. You know, that's another thing. Like, you know, with the Michael Jackson, Janet Jackson thing, you got to pick a side.
That's true. Okay, I hear you. All right.
So
okay,
can I just ask an Atlanta question?
Check, no, go ahead.
Because you mentioned that Atlanta, you know, is in a place where most major cities aren't as far as programs and things of that nature. And one of those reasons I feel like maybe because they are so new in this industry, but another reason is because of the politics in Atlanta. You know, not so much Georgia, but maybe Atlanta. And I was just curious if you have made, because everybody's been talking about Atlanta politics lately and the potential that you guys have. Are you like involved in the culture of the politics?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, my goal is to make sure that people understand that Atlanta is mentally a different space, right? And I grew up in a different mindset than he grew up in Philly. Where are you from?
Indiana.
Oh, yeah, I grew up in a different mind, definitely different mindset than you in Indiana. Black people in Atlanta are not intimidated by white people and are not intimidated by anybody of a different color with money.
Now.
Never.
Never?
Never. We have never been...
That ain't post-Olympics neither?
Never been intimidated, like, to the point where we don't believe that we can do it. You understand what I'm saying? Like, and that mentality goes deep. That's the mentality that Martin Luther King had. If you listen to what he was saying, he was thinking from a unbothered mindset. He didn't believe anything could touch him based on what he was saying. And if he would have stayed in Atlanta, he probably would have still been alive. Right? Because that's the mindset of the city, right? When you look at, you know, last 2 weeks ago when I was filming the rap game, I took the kids from other cities and I called the mayor and I was like, yo, I want you to be on my TV show and I want you to talk to these kids. And she was like, okay, cool, come, I'm gonna give you time, blah, 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 blah. Now, that I made it look easy, but I'm saying, in when I'm looking at hip hop on the rest of these, you know, the networks and all of this, how many times you see all these rappers hanging with their mayors? Like, it's not really a true connection. They represent their cities, but they're not really connected to the way that we are in Atlanta. And we make, and our cultural people, the mayors and the politicians, they make sure that they pay attention to what's happening inside our neighborhoods and what we're doing in these neighborhoods to get Atlanta to this place, right? Atlanta's almost about to be the first state or city with a black governor and a black mayor female at the same time.
Both female, both, yeah, black,
both,
women.
Both, yes. Both black women.
Yes.
This is about to happen. And I just think that, you know, the mindset of a black person coming from Atlanta is just a lot different than everybody else. So I think that's why that's going like that. It's like, we don't have no intimidation. I'll move next. You got a big ass house, I'm gonna get a big ass house. And there's nothing that's intimidating about me. Like, it's no area in Atlanta, if you know.
Yeah.
Like, in other cities, they got white areas.
Right.
Or they got a different area. In Atlanta, if the shit is hot, the niggas is going.
Yeah, I'm
that's
what's
like, oh, that's what, oh, over there, the houses cost $10 million. Psh, best believe, my homeboy from College Park, he gonna be over there a week from now. Like, it's nothing intimidating in Atlanta. Everything is, no area is off limits. If this the area where everybody say they rich at, then Big Meech gonna be over there. You know what I mean? That's just that's the mentality of Atlanta, and that's I want people to know that, and I think that's why people come there, because they start gathering that and like, damn, this is what's happening out here. I'm, you know, I never, and I've seen Spike Lee do a lot in Brooklyn, but I don't believe that Spike Lee could go talk to the mayor of New York and they have a real cool thing and show everybody, and it's right. Something that's fly that happens and the mayor understands what he's talking about, and I don't see this type of stuff, right? And that's why I feel like Tyler Perry, what he's doing, yeah, only could happen in Atlanta.
Yeah.
Because there's no other place that supports the movement the way, and it's no intimidation.
There you have it, ladies and gentlemen.
We move it to Atlanta again.
From the future, once the future governor of Atlanta, Jermaine Dupri.
Oh.
Brother,
I got two questions.
Oh, good.
Two quick questions. Okay. First one, let's brag on your catalog a little bit. Is there any record, what's one record that you've done that didn't really get the attention you thought it should have gotten that you think we should all go back and listen to?
I can answer that question.
But you're not Jermaine Dupri, so I'd like his answer first.
I'm still jumping. The clip's on. Okay, good.
Fallen.
Or on the Jay-Z record?
Oh, okay. You know what? Yeah, yeah.
Shit, you did that?
Yeah
look at you.
American Gangster, right?
With Bilal.
And the Bilal's hook, I sung it, and he's singing it just like me.
You did a couple of records where you used Bilal.
Look at him.
Couple of Bilal records.
Damn, I didn't, because in my head, Puffy did that whole record.
No way.
I got one for you, and I always thought this song should have been a single.
It different.
I thought this song should have been a single from Janet's 20-year-old record, 20 years old record. Do It To Me.
100%.
That should have been a single.
Totally.
With the Brenda Russell sample.
No, yeah. Brenda Russell.
That shit is my favorite song on that record.
100%.
By far. And my last question.
Yes.
You've worked with a lot of people, like all kinds of names, big, small. Who is on your list of people that you want to work with that you haven't had a chance to work with yet?
Nobody.
Nobody.
Yeah.
Nobody.
Not at this point, because I've been in a room with people who have the craziest work ethic, and you know, if I don't see that in you outside of me working with you, I'm not really trying to go in that direction. You know what I mean? I had Aretha Franklin tell me that I wasn't talking to her enough when she was in the booth. That's what really made me really turn into more of a vocal producer and talk to the artists when they're in the studio. Because I was sitting in the studio, I think I was like a fan, and I was just like Aretha Franklin singing my song.
It's like, I can't tell Aretha Franklin what to do.
I can't tell the Queen of Soul nothing. Yeah. And she hit the button like, yo, are you going to say something?
Say something.
She's like, why did you come way out here if you ain't going to talk to me? I go home and cook. And I was like, oh, shit. Okay, this what you want me to say. I'm going to tell you then. That note was wrong. And, you know, she got me out of that zone to just tell artists whatever I wanted to tell them. Wow. And I had already been like that, but when you don't vocal the song, and you just write a song, and then you get somebody else to sing the song, it's different. Because usually when my vocals on there, I don't have to tell them because they're listening to it. Right. But when it's an artist listening to somebody else, then you have to tell them exactly what you. And I wasn't really paying attention to that till I did the song with Aretha Franklin. And that's one of the songs that I wish would have been bigger, because if I had a bigger record by Aretha Franklin, y'all wouldn't have been able to tell me shit.
Understandably so, yeah.
Wow.
Well, I still feel like I can't tell you shit because you've sold a lot more records than I have. So,
all right.
A lot more records than I have, which that total is zero. So,
well, brother, I thank you for coming on the show. Yeah. This episode has been long overdue.
Yes, it has.
Give it up for Jermaine Dupri, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you.
Future, we should mention future. Songwriting Hall of Fame.
Yes, Thursday.
Yeah.
Less than 72 hours. I'm so high about this. And
congratulations.
Yeah. And I'm going to work right now. I'm going to meet Mariah at the studio as we speak.
Yes, back in together suit. Again.
He's sharp.
Whoa.
All right. Well, on behalf of Team Supreme, Laia, Boss Bill, and Sugar Steve, this is Questlove. We will see you on the next round of Questlove Supreme. Peace.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. This classic episode was produced by the team at Pandora.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.